this modernist structure. You've already seen inside this building, and even if you don't know it, here's Sir Joseph Lockwood in the middle. It looks like Nipper's kissing his head there, doesn't it? It's nice. Nipper, the HMV dog, the RCA Victrola dog in the US. Sir Joseph Lockwood was a businessman. He was a businessman. He took over EMI when it was failing after the war because they were really heavily invested in hardware, record players, gramophones. And the thing is, when you bought a record player or a gramophone, that was it, you had one. And so you're not going to get repeat custom. And he thought, well, the hardware, you know, it's not going to make us lots of money ongoing. We need to make software. We need to branch out in a wider way with our software. And the four fellas in the picture there, they made software for EMI Records. So Joseph Lockwood was a businessman. He wasn't a music guy at all. He did get into business in hardware. He saw the television coming and he thought this would be, you know, a big deal. So he, on behalf of EMI, struck a deal with a company called Thorn. Thorn EMI, very famous in our country for making televisions. So he put EMI back into the black and the Beatles helped him. Here's inside the building. You've seen it, as I said. This is the sleeve for Please Please Me on the Stairwell in 1963, the Beatles' first album. In 1969, they were going to do an album called Get Back, which looked like this. Same guys, same spot, same photographer. The album sleeve was never released like that. It became Let It Be, the Let It Be album in 1970. But yeah, they're back at the original location. There's the original. There's the 1969 version, which was eventually used, of course, on the Red and the Blue album, as we call them today. The balustrade that they're leaning over there was moved when the building was knocked down. When EMI moved to Kensington, this balustrade moved with them. It was purchased 2 years ago by Paul McCartney for an undisclosed fee. So the balustrade is currently in Paul McCartney's house in Surrey. Here's the Beach Boys outside EMI. This was the thing to pose outside the headquarters of the company. There's Pink Floyd doing a kick line, looking like a pop group, which they certainly were not outside of EMI. And here's a letter sent from the BBC to Sir Joseph regarding the Beatles' A Day in the Life. It opens, "I never thought the day would come." This isn't going to go well, is it? "I never thought the day would come." A rather sinister meaning was found in A Day in the Life by the BBC, the Beatles song from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It may have been made in innocence and good faith, wrote Frank Gillard of the BBC, director of sound broadcasting, but it contains the jargon of drug addicts, and this will never do. So it was banned by the BBC. BBC and EMI in conflict. This is the BBC. Portland Place. Let's have a look at Broadcasting House here. George Valmeyer is the architect here. Here's BH in Portland Place. Here's a photograph taken from the BBC website. And we've got the BBC News Department. Television news is still in here. Here's the original Broadcasting House from the 1920s. And this wing here is now called, just the bit at the back here, is called the John Peel Wing, named for the BBC DJ and champion of alternative music, John Peel, at the BBC. So radio's still in here. And the relationship between the BBC and pop music and music in general has long been quite a complicated relationship. Here's Henry Hall. His big hit was Teddy Bear's Picnic. That's on your playlist, which is coming to you tomorrow. He used to broadcast live from the BBC every day. And live is the thing, because the BBC had a problem with recorded music. And they entered into the needle time agreement with the musicians' union. They didn't play too much recorded music to preserve the livelihood of musicians. It really holds them back in the 1960s when pop music is exploding. But they played a lot of live music. Henry Hall broadcast every day. Teddy Bear's Picnic, that was his big hit. Oh. And here's the first DJ from the BBC. Now, you Google that. Go and Google that. First DJ at the BBC, and who comes up? Tony Blackburn. Tony Blackburn always comes up as the first disc jockey at the BBC. Now, I'm using the phrase disc jockey, that terrific American phrase, the people who play records on the radio. And that was one of the ways that Charles Chilton was described in his obituary in the Daily Telegraph. He was the first DJ at the BBC. He also happens to be the father of Mary, who's here from London Walks tonight. This is Mary's dad, Charles Chilton. Also a London Walks guide in his time as well. He made a great many well-respected television programmes, radio programmes, I beg your pardon, at the BBC. He's held in very high regard. He had a jazz programme playing jazz music on the BBC. You can't imagine how scandalous that was. The programme went out at 11:30 at night, so it was out of the way of respectable people, you know. And it got a huge mailbag. It was incredibly popular. And when the volume of mail started coming in, the bosses started to say, well, we better listen to this programme and see what it was all about. And when they tuned in and heard Charles Chilton's wonderful London tones broadcasting on the BBC while he was removed from the programme for not having the BBC voice, that's how we used to roll. A very influential writer and broadcaster on music. I have a couple of his books on the shelf here. The first DJ, if you like pop music, that's quite a special thing. Britain's first DJ. Here's John Reith, Lord Reith. This is the face of every Scottish Presbyterian minister you've ever seen. His God is a vengeful God. And not only that, he's having a bad day. Thou shalt not. Reith wasn't famous for music. In fact, Reith's taste in music was once described by a rival as deplorable, especially his affection for Pam Court music. Deplorable taste in music, according to Dennis Foreman, the chairman of Granada TV. He did institute the practice of broadcasting evensong, choral evensong on the BBC, which is a tradition that continues on Radio 3. But as you can probably tell from his Scottish Presbyterian scowl there, it wasn't much of a pop music fan. Here's Tony Blackburn, he's smiling. Look at the contrast between these two individuals here. There's Lord Reith, there's Tony Blackburn, broadcasting at sea on Radio Caroline. And there in the background there, that's the horizon, the actual sea, broadcasting on board Radio Caroline, pirate radio. Tony Blackburn, often something of a figure of fun in our country, but we forget that he was a great pioneer of black music on the BBC. His knowledge of soul music and rhythm and blues back in the day was, you know, second to none. And if there were ever any repairs to be done on pirate radio, he was the first guy up the mast, you know, to fix the transmitter. So he was game. Here he is broadcasting for Radio Caroline in his T-shirt. And then he moved to the BBC. Well, you have to wear one of these fellas here, one of these contraptions. Do you see that? That's called a necktie. My goodness, this is the BBC. We're going to deal with Tony Blackburn and the BBC and the Needle Time Agreement and the Marine Broadcasting Act 1967 a little later in the series on Radio Days, where I'm going to try and combine science and show business, a history of radio. Wish me luck with that one.